Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Tomorrow in Rome, 83-year-old Pope John Paul II celebrates 25 years as head of the Catholic Church. His goal, he signaled early on, was to cross every threshold to never be a prisoner of the Vatican. He has certainly kept that promise. The Pope, who skied, has crisscrossed the globe for the past quarter century. He was the first Pope to visit a mosque and a synagogue. He has been credited with a key role in the downfall of the Soviet Union. But critics of the Holy See call John Paul II a fifth-century pope, profoundly conservative in ways that have held back women, mishandled birth control and gays, and sustained a culture that led to the shocking priest sex abuse scandal. Tonight on Point, John Paul II and the power of one pope. We begin in Rome. John Allen is Vatican correspondent with the Catholic Reporter. I asked him to describe the mood and scene there on the eve of the Pope's celebration gala.
Well, for the last 24 hours or so, Rome has been filling up with pilgrims who are here both for the Pope's anniversary tomorrow. We'll have, the special anniversary mass tomorrow afternoon about 6 p.m. local time, which, of course, would be about noon on the East Coast in the States. But people also are arriving for Mother Teresa's beatification this Sunday. I mean, one of the more striking sights on Roman streets these days is a wave after wave of Mother Teresa's nuns in those distinctive white saris with the blue trim. And so it's a very colorful and very excited Rome building up to tomorrow's events.
Speaking of waves, the Pope waived the mandatory 5-year waiting period for Mother Teresa's beatification. This Pope has created more saints and beatified more people than any pontiff in history. He's traveled more, spoken more, published more, but his health has not looked good. What is the status of the Pope's health?
Well, I think, first of all, the beatifications and canonizations. I mean, it's not just that he's done more than previous popes. He's actually canonized and beatified more than all previous popes combined. I mean, it's an astonishing record. But in terms of his health, you're right. I mean, you know, I think the thing to remember is about 60% of the Pope's time is actually public. And his condition, therefore, unfolds before the public eye. And for the most part, what you see is what you get. And I think what you're seeing these days is an increasingly weak, increasingly limited, frail, 83-year-old man who cannot stand under his own power, who cannot walk, and who gets fatigued trying to read even brief texts and often needs help. But having said all that, this is also a Pope who was determined to keep going, and certainly the strong conviction in the inner circles around the Pope is that he will be able to do that for some time to come.
There have been rumors of the possibility of a resignation. That hasn't happened since Celestine V in 1294. Are those being absolutely ruled out by the Vatican? And what happens if the Pope's condition deteriorates further? Parkinson's disease is progressive. What happens if he gets to a point where he simply can't be the robust Pope that he had been?
Well, he already is not the robust Pope he had been. And, I mean, you know, as we were watching footage of his election 25 years ago, you know, skiing, mountain climbing, athletic Pope sort of burst onto the world stage, and comparing it with the pictures of the bent and in some ways broken elderly man we see today, I mean, that contrast just jumps out at you. On the other hand, this Pope and his closest aides have emphatically said time and again that he has no intention of resigning. Most recently, this evening, 81-year-old Cardinal Bernard Gantin, one of the Pope's closest friends, gave an address to the other cardinals tonight in which he said flat out, popes do not resign. They are elected as servants for life. That very much is the conviction. And I think, you know, the thing to add to that is that John Paul II is a man who was firmly convinced that on May 13th, 1981, the Virgin Mary changed the flight path of a bullet to keep him in office. That was the date of the assassination attempt. It was also the feast day of Our Lady of Fatima. And I think if that's your worldview, if you believe that God and the Virgin are arranging things in order to put you where you are and to keep you there, you never can feel that it's up to you to decide when it's over. I think John Paul is convinced that the duration of his pontificate is in the hands of God, and that's where he's determined to leave it.
John Allen, you've covered the Pope for a long time. What are the high points you'd look at? The assassination attempt, clearly a very low point, but high points in this Pope's long time in the Vatican?
Well, I mean, there are a lot to pick out, but I mean, I think just to name two or three, certainly the first trip to Poland in 1979, when the Pope stood in Victory Square in Warsaw before a crowd of over a million people.
The first non-Italian pontiff in 450-some years.
That's exactly right. And he stood there with the Soviet world watching and said, you know, Christ cannot be removed from the history of this nation. I mean, it was an indirect, very clear bit of defiance that, in its own way, set in motion the dominoes that led to the fall of the Berlin Wall. I would also think his trip during the Holy Year, that is 2000, to the Holy Land, to Jerusalem, where he stood there in the Wailing Wall and left behind that note apologizing for centuries of Christian anti-Semitism, revolutionizing the relationship with Judaism. May 2001, when he became the first pope ever to enter an Islamic mosque, I was with him in Damascus, the Grand Umayyad Mosque, which was an enormous event of great consequence in the Islamic world. Lots of highlights. I mean, you know, in 25 years, I think there's probably no political, cultural, social, religious issue that hasn't in some way cut across this man's tenure in office.
And what about John Paul II's greatest difficulties, the issues that have dogged him during those same years?
Well, I've written a piece recently about the Pope's failures, and I think, you know, you can probably say that there are four that loom out. The first is with Russia. I mean, the Pope has long wanted to travel to Moscow. That's been denied to him. He's wanted to heal this millennium-old split between Eastern and Western Christianity. He's not been able to do it. Second would be China. You have, obviously, a billion people in China. It's an emerging global superpower. The Pope has wanted to visit Peking. That, too, has been denied to him. I think with women, this has been a pope in many ways who has tried to reach out to women, and yet the alienation that many women feel, especially in the developed world, from the church and from this pope is quite profound. And I think finally, the whole issue of the culture, what the pope has called a culture of death in the West, issues like abortion and birth control and sex outside of marriage, same-sex rights, where the pope has strenuously made arguments that large majorities of people in the West appear not to buy. And in that sense, he has failed to persuade many of the people he's been trying to persuade these 25 years. I think those four areas would probably represent his greatest frustrations.
Tomorrow, he'll be present at a long mass. Do we know what his message will be?
No, we have not yet seen his homily, but we expect it to be a sort of synthesis of the core ideas of his pontificate. And I think if you had to boil it all down to one phrase, it would be that key phrase the Pope has intoned time and again, which is, be not afraid. And that, I think, has been his message to the Christian community and to the world, that in a time when institutional religion seemed to be sliding into extinction, when the Catholic Church seemed to be locked in its own internecine quarrel, he has come along and said, be not afraid. You know, have the courage to take your message out in the street and be confident of who you are. And I expect he'll hit that note again tomorrow.
John, thanks very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
John Allen is Vatican correspondent with the Catholic Reporter. He spoke with me from Rome. We're talking tonight about the power of one pope. What's your 25 years on view of Pope John Paul II? Do you see a liberator from communism and anti-Semitism? A reactionary who has trapped the church in the past? Has this pope spoken to the causes and issues you want championed? And where have 25 years of Pope John Paul brought Rome and the U.S. Catholic Church? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Father Michael Bugarin, Executive Director of the Pope John Paul II Second Cultural Center. Good evening and welcome, Father Bugarin.
Good evening, Tom. Good to be with you.
Great to have you. Also joining us tonight from Evanston, Illinois, is Gary Wills, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and author of the provocative book, Why I Am a Catholic, as well as Papal Sin and St. Augustine. Good evening and welcome, Gary Wills.
Hello.
Thanks for being with us. Michael Bugarin, to you first. A very big anniversary tomorrow, 25 years. Very few popes have served for that long. What's your sense of this pope's legacy as the crowds come into Rome and the Vatican tomorrow, as everyone prepares for Mother Teresa's beatification? Has he brought the church together more than he's driven it apart?
Oh, he definitely has brought the church together. It's an incredible opportunity. I was in Rome last week and could just feel the fervor of celebration already starting to mount. And I can only imagine what it's like listening to John Allen talk about all the people that are celebrating in Rome to be with the Holy Father tomorrow. It's a remarkable opportunity for us as a church to celebrate.
But this is a pope who very much loved, very widely traveled, has gathered millions around him wherever he's traveled. At the same time, he's accused of pushing back on Vatican II, of ignoring or making impossible kinds of evolution in the church that many people would like to see. When you look at Catholics in the United States, let's say, and how they perceive this pope, again, same question. Has he brought more unity than discord?
I definitely brought a bunch of unity. I was ordained a priest in 1991. Most of my life has been around Pope John Paul II. I was a seminarian in Rome, And I think he's done incredible things for the church. You look at what he's done, picking up on John Allen's statements about the Holy Father's initial line at his homily at his installation mass. Be not afraid. Open wide the doors to Christ. He's constantly opening up, his own arms and welcoming people and trying to bridge so many different cultures and ways of life.
Gary Wills, you've been a pretty tough critic. When you sit back on this anniversary and look at this Pope's legacy, I mean, he's still there, but there's already a big legacy. It's clearly got many parts to it, but how do you interpret it?
Well, I went to Rome when he was first made Pope and wrote an article for the New York Magazine, interviewed a lot of people at the Vatican. And it was a very exciting time. He was a wonderfully engaging, energetic, attractive person, electric. I mean, I shook hands with him. But I said at the time, he reminds me, I think, of Pius IX, who also began a career as very popular, very lovable. And then as his papacy went on, he closed in on himself, and the Vatican closed in, became a very tight, sealed place. And John Henry Newman said, no one should be pope more than 20 years. He becomes a despot. He was talking about Pius IX, who is a hero to this pope. He beatified him, even though the pope had canonized a Spanish inquisitor who killed Jews. And in the canonization document, Pius IX said, this should be a lesson to modern Jews. So I think that he has traced the arc of Pius IX, beginning with a really tremendous contribution, more than Pius IX did. You know, Pius IX was very liberal. He freed the Jews from ghettos and things. But this pope helped to bring down a very cruel regime in the Eastern Bloc. And that will always be to his credit. And he should have received the Nobel Prize long ago, and he should have received it this year. On the other hand, if you want to know what I think will be his historic importance, he is the only pope I know of who has tried to undo an ecumenical council of the church.
With what consequence?
Well, he failed. You know, most people are still living in the Vatican Council of Church. But let me give, you know, there are many examples. Let me give a simple one. The Second Vatican Council tried to revive the collegial authority of the bishops. Mm-hmm. In 1998, the Pope, seeing national conferences of bishops doing what he didn't like, a catechism in Holland, liberation theology in Latin America, women in America, issued a motu proprio, Apostolos Suos, saying, no national conference of bishops can take binding action except on two conditions, that it be unanimous, so one conservative bishop can veto it, and that it be approved by Rome. Now, what that did, it took away all the powers of the bishops, so that they had to invent tricky maneuvers to get around that in the Dallas meeting. They had to invent a charter which didn't exist before, which was voluntary, which was not binding. They had to invent norms to go around the reporting to Rome. He has taken away their power over the liturgy, over education, over seminary training. Even though he himself, as the head of a national conference of bishops when he was Karol Wojtyla in Poland, was very strong on national council.
Taken that power and centralized it back in Rome, Father
Absolutely.
Michael Bugarin, what about the impact of that? The church is clearly in many corners looking to evolve. Can that evolution, is it appropriate, first of all? And if it is, can it coexist with this highly centralized authority that John Paul II has brought back to Rome?
Well, I think you have to also look at the fact that we're looking at a worldwide church and trying to create some type of rules and regulations that everyone can abide by. Quite the contrary, there is a great spirit of collegial power that is given to the bishops, and it's an opportunity for them to work together with the Vatican administration and the curial appointments to be able to celebrate the fact that we are a worldwide organization.
But there's no question he's been a very strong hand at the center. Gary Wills, Michael Bugarin, please stand by. We're talking tonight about Pope John Paul II's 25 years at the head of the Catholic Church and its impact on that church and the world. You can join the conversation What's your 25-year view of John Paul II? Did you thrill to the vigorous young pope skiing the Alps and circling the planet? What's your relationship with the aging pope, Brent Bent and Frail? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Pope John Paul II's 25 years at the head of the Catholic Church and his impact on that church and the world. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you see a liberator in this pope from the Soviet Union, from anti-Semitism, or a reactionary who has trapped the church in the past? And has this pope spoken for the church, the causes that you want championed? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight from Washington by Father Michael Bugarin. He's executive director of the Pope John Paul II Cultural Center there. He's been with the pope on many international trips, including several trips to Poland and Cuba in 1998. And from Evanston, Illinois, by Gary Wills, historian at Northwestern University, spent 6 years himself in seminary, did not go on to become a priest, but has written at great depth about the Catholic Church, including its most recently, Why I Am a Catholic, now out in paperback. He won the 1993 Pulitzer Prize for Gettysburg, the words that remade America. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I want to start out looking at the things where everybody really agrees the Pope has been truly remarkable. And Gary Wills, I was surprised to hear you in citing the relationship between John Paul II and Pius IX, pointing at Pius II's tough actions and words on the Jews. That's been a place where this pope has been fairly universally lauded. He grew up in Poland and in the upstairs apartment of a house owned by Jews. When he came back after the war, they were gone. And he has been famously sympathetic to their plight and ambitious in building bridges between Catholics and Jews pretty much ever since, hasn't he? Doesn't that fall in the fully positive sector of this pope's legacy?
Well, it falls in the positive, but not the fully, as you will find if you talk to many Jews. He has apologized for what members of the church did. He has never apologized for what was church teaching. It was taught in seminaries. It was in the theological manuals. It was in the liturgy that the Jews had killed Christ. He's never apologized for the church teaching, for the authorities, only for members.
So his famous apology...
It's the same approach he has taken to the pedophile scandal. He came to Canada, and he apologized for priests who had violated young people. He has never apologized, never rebuked a bishop who covered that up. Authorities cannot be criticized, in his view. Cardinal Law, he finally had to accept his resignation, but he did not rebuke him. He stays in cardinal in good standing. He's on various Vatican commissions. He attends the National Conference of Bishops meetings. He speaks there. He will vote for the new pope. Authority can do no wrong in this pope's eyes. He has never apologized for it. He has never said it could do wrong. And many Jews realize that and resent it. And, you know, with Pius IX, it was not only the canonization of the inquisitor. Pius IX kidnapped a young Jewish boy because he had been secretly baptized, apparently. He also said, although he had freed Jews from the ghetto earlier on, later on when he found that his authority was gone over the Roman Jews, he said they had to go back into the ghetto because they were running dogs in the street. Now, if you beatify that man, what is a Jew to think?
Father Michael Bugarin, how about it? This pope walked across many boundaries, went to Jerusalem, went to the Wailing Wall, did issue an apology. Gary Wills takes issue with the content of that apology. But he appears to have built a bridge that had never been built in this way before. Was something left out?
I think what we have to focus in on is that the Holy Father has gone extraordinary miles to build these bridges. He has taken the church out of Rome. He's taken the church to the world. He is the most traveled pope. You know, he has traveled some 700,000 miles. You know, you reflect on the experience down in Cuba and Poland, just going to the Holy Land, which was a long life dream of his, and being able to go to the Western Wall, the Wailing Wall, and to put his own note of reconciliation and pardon. And, he's done incredible things to build these bridges. And I think we have to always hold on to,
you know, to the message he had from his homily.
But what, I'm sorry, yes, go ahead.
No, just be not afraid. This Pope is an incredible Pope. He's never closed himself in. He's constantly opened up his arms to dialogue with people of all faiths and all ways of life. And he's constantly building bridges. He's constantly doing whatever he can to bring people around the table to dialogue and, you know, to build the reconciliation that needs to be. And he's done that only not only by word, but by his very own examples.
Yeah, Gary Wills said he probably deserves the Nobel Prize, though he didn't get it. David Brooks writes in the New York Times that he's bigger than the Nobel Prize. And yet Gary Wills says, where you say he's reached out to the world, Gary and others say, yes, but he's pulled authority back to the center in a very remarkable way. Is that a problem for a church that is as global as the Catholic Church?
I'm a canon lawyer. I can tell you that there's a need for law. There's a need for bringing some of the centralization. Again, we're dealing with a worldwide organization, a worldwide church, and trying to reflect the law of the church that looks at all the different cultures. And again, that's a hallmark of Pope John Paul II, is bridging the relationship between faith and culture. And that's one of his hallmarks. And everything that he has done, everything he has talked about, is building that bridge between faith and culture.
Michael Bergara and Gary Wills, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Kenneth Woodward. He joins us from New York. He's religion editor for the past 38 years at Newsweek magazine, a longer tenure than the Pope. He's author of Making Saints, How the Catholic Church Determines Who Becomes a Saint, Who Doesn't, and Why. Good evening and welcome, Kenneth Woodward.
Glad to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. Many minds turning to the Pope as he celebrates 25 years in the Holy See. Tomorrow, lavish praise for his role in bringing down the Soviet Union, for his role in reaching out across religious lines to Jews, to Muslims, to other Christians. Also, criticism, very sharp and deep criticism of the Pope for the gathering in of authority, for his positions on sexual morality, the rights of women, prerogatives of an all-male celibate priesthood, religious pluralism. How do you what do you think the lasting impact of this Pope is going to be, Kenneth Woodward, with that picture, with that debate that he leaves behind his powerful presence?
Look, I think this Pope put his face on Catholicism. I mean, all the trips that you mentioned, it was his face that we saw.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of office which allows that sort of thing, and he took advantage of it. He personalized it in a way that his immediate operative predecessor, Paul VI, did not. Although he did it in a way that John the 23rd did it in what was a very short tenure. Mm. So that personalization invites the diverse reactions to the person of the Pope. And if your ambition is for one kind of church and he didn't augment that, then you're critical of him. If your vision of the church is another kind, it's too easy to say, then you support him.
But it's not just a personality issue, is it? As strong as that personality may be, there are real, very real moves the Pope has taken over the years. He looked at liberation theology. He said, no, that's not the way.
I think he's kind of mixed on liberation theology. You know, I think he's speaking out of an anti-Marxist Polish background. Liberation theology got awful scholastic toward the end. I think Gary's right to point to this man's reflexive defense of authority. And I think, again, that comes out of his Polish background. I don't mean to read the foreground. I mean the most recent stuff in terms of his background. But, it's right. I think that his experience in Poland, where the authority of the church, which he, in that culture you could draw on as a strength, over the authority of the state has conditioned him in a certain sense, and made him blind to other forms of authority in, say, the bishops' conferences and so forth. And I think that the history of the papacy is such that you see swings, and despite the fact that he's appointed most of the cardinals who will elect the next pope, I think they'll swing back in a different direction, because I think they'll all see that that's needed, and they themselves participate in that, in, you know, in that shared authority. I'd be surprised to be somebody that they would elect somebody reactionary the next time around. So, yeah, I think they probably see his strengths and his weaknesses at the same time.
Gary Wills, funny that a pope like this should come along at a time when the world was liberalizing in so many ways. He's celebrated for defending what David Brooks calls the whole and indivisible dignity of each person, and yet took issue with many of the kind of personal decisions that people in modern societies were struggling to make around sexuality, around gender issues, around authority issues with the church. Is there a contradiction in this pope there?
Well, you say it's odd that he comes along. It's not really that odd. Peter Steinfeld has just published a wonderful book in which he says that the church authorities, not the church itself, the church authorities have almost reflexively resisted vast, what he calls, axial shifts in the world. Mm. He gives as examples the scientific revolution, the democratic revolution. The reflex of the authorities was to say, science is all wrong, it's challenging our basic age-old wisdom, Galileo's wrong, we've got to condemn this and that and the other thing. In the 19th century, when democracy and accountability was displacing monarchy, the papacy said, this is wrong, democracy is only a second best. It shut up John Courtney Murray for saying that it was not that. Hmm. Change on that scale frightens keepers of what they consider age-old wisdom. And he says another change on that scale has taken place now. It's the huge axial shift in personal relationships, of which the principal evidence is the status of women. Mm-hmm. For the first time in history, in any culture, the equality of women was taken seriously at the end of the 20th century with incredible results. Because if you change that, you change society at its deepest tie. You change the relationship of wife to husband, of mother to children, of daughter to parents, of sister to siblings, of woman employer to employees, of woman employee to employers, of professional colleagues. You change everything.
Right across the board.
That has gone across so that the economy changes, women work, the family changes. We have small families. You have to educate people not to have 11 people on the farm, but get two or three people through college. All of those changes are an interrelated social shift.
I would agree, but you know what? The papacy is a conservative institution, and I would not be surprised by a kind of delayed response to that, not only because it's conservative, but also because all these changes have been, it seems to me, at best ambivalent in their responses. Having liberated women to work, we find, all of us who are parents can speak to this, enormous stresses on people, a preoccupation with identity that comes through work, which is not necessarily a good thing.
So are you saying, Kenneth Woodward, that it's then the Pope's job to drag a foot out the car as it moves into social change, to slow things down, even push things back, or is it the Pope's job to help the Church adapt to a changed society?
Well, maybe the way you adapt to a changed society is by dragging a foot. Maybe as the engines of inevitable progress, move forward and their tribunes trumpet what they consider positive aspects of this. Maybe, the papacy is one place where you can say, hey, wait a minute. Not all of these changes are necessarily good. And that's exactly what I am saying. So yes, I mean, when there's nothing more fundamental than the relationship between men and women, and I think the Jerry and I may differ on this. I'm sure we do, but I don't think that the changes that have gone on with respect to women have been uniformly good, and so I'm not surprised that they would be slow at that. Look, you know, as a very practical matter, I would think that if they were to, say, ordain women, and of course they would have to be married women because why limit it to single women, would produce enormous sociological changes in this church. And I can't blame a pope, especially given his background, but almost any background, saying, wait, and maybe dragging not 1 but 2 feet on this. Because it would so change all kinds of structures in the church. And I would add, and these are fighting words, I'm sure, that it is not hasn't necessarily proven to be a good thing in the churches in which these changes have taken place. But the most important note is that the Catholic priesthood, as it's understood by the Catholic Church, is something very different from the ministry in Protestant congregations. They can more easily adapt to these things. My problem with the Pope in this respect is that he said he doesn't want anybody to talk about it. Well, of course, everybody's talking about it. And I think even Gary Wills would agree that we have a number of women who are good theologians and good scholars, not to mention an awful lot of good women have given their lives to the church, and the fact that we have women not only involved in the seminary training of priests, but also are articulating different feminist perspectives.
So the pressures mount out there, but there's a powerful pope who's kind of barred the door, even as he's thrilled people on many other fronts. Drew's calling from Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Drew, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thank you.
Sure.
I remember being in Haiti when the pope came in the early 80s, and he actually spoke not just in French, he spoke in Haitian Creole, and he stood next to Jean-Claude Duvalier and said the importance of leaders not to trot on their people. And when you consider the fact that he's been consistently against crippling economic embargoes and crippling third world debt, I believe he was well deserving of the Nobel Peace Prize. And then when you consider the fact that Henry Kissinger has one and he gave the green light for the invasion of East Timor, it really might not be much of a prize anyway.
But maybe the Pope's bigger than the Nobel Prize. But what about these issues where he's resisted social change? Is that a net positive for you, Drew, or a negative?
I think it's maybe a mixed bag in how everybody looks at it. I look at the big picture. I look at economic embargoes and what they do to countries and third world debt. And you just look at the body count. You just look at the mortality, and you look at the, you know, what would mean bigger changes in the world. You know, the economic embargoes and the...
And there you see the Pope standing there. And, of course, he opposed the war in Iraq. Drew, thanks for your call. We've got to take a short break. We're talking about Pope John Paul's 25 years at the head of the Catholic Church. Has this Pope spoken for the church, the causes that you want championed? Has he anchored the Catholic Church or cut off its evolution? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Pope John Paul's 25 years at the head of the Catholic Church and his impact on that church and on the world. My guest tonight, Father Michael Bouguerin, Executive Director of the Pope John Paul II Cultural Center in Washington, D.C. From New York, joining us tonight, Kenneth Woodward, Religion Editor for Newsweek magazine for the last 38 years. And from Evanston, Illinois, Gary Wills, historian at Northwestern University, Pulitzer Prize winner, author of Why I Am a Catholic, Papal Sin and St. Augustine. You can join the conversation as well at 1-800-423-8255. Bill's calling from Northborough, Massachusetts. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Good evening. It's interesting listening to Father dance around some of the questions that you've put towards him, but let me get on to my comments. No organization and no pontiff has made more of an issue of veritas, of the truth, than has Roman Catholicism and the papacy, and this pope in particular. And no organization and no pope has done more to go out of their way to avoid facing the truth.
What truth are you speaking to there, Bill?
Let's talk about, for example, past anti-Semitism in Roman Catholicism and Gary Wills' book, Papal Sin, Structures of Deceit, as well as his other book that you talked about, namely Why I Am a Catholic, outlines that very clearly, as well as James Carroll's book, Constantine's Sword.
But how can you say no pope has gone further to avoid the truth? I mean, this was a pope that went to Jerusalem, that went to the Western Wall, that made the apology, that said it makes us cry out at Yad Vashem, the Holocaust center there. I mean,
allow me to answer the question. Yes, he did all of the things that you mentioned. But then when it came down to facing what exactly was Roman Catholicism's part in all of this, he didn't do it. And Gary Wills brought it out before. He said individuals within the church did it, but the church itself was not responsible. Never mind the fact that it was church doctrine that there was, quote, no salvation outside the church, and that there were church laws that said Jews could not do this and Jews could not do that, and that there was burning at the stake of heretics and this sort of thing. This is a man that cannot face the total truth as to what Roman Catholicism has done.
Bill, we've got it. And let us pick it up. Kenneth Woodward, if this pope hasn't faced it, what's it going to take to face it? I mean, he seems to have gone the extra mile after mile after mile on this front. What's the final step?
Well, first of all, Jewish spokesmen are going to do as they always do, focus on the positive. And I'm sorry, I don't think you're going to find many Jews who are going to say that this guy was not a great help to them. It's an inner Nicene Catholic thing that talks about, well, he didn't say this and he didn't say that. As I said before, he had a real hard time of criticizing authority, as Gary Will said. There are different models of the church, and he tends to invoke a highly spiritual model so that the concrete model doesn't get criticized that much. But you know, I lean on the Jewish leadership here there, and they'll pick through these things and said I think they'll say this guy, as John the 23rd in another way made their life one hell of a lot easier, and I would go with them as to the kind of the kind of response. And as you know,
Gary Wills, let me turn that to you as well, Gary, if I may. Gary, what's that other step that you're waiting for?
It's very simple. He should have said church authorities taught anti-Semitism. It's as simple as that. It's an historical truth. It's very easy to say. The Vatican Council came right up to saying it and didn't. You know, the idea that he's the first one.
We're losing you a little bit there, Gary, but the idea that, but can a pope say that church authorities, that previous popes were wrong? We've lost Gary for a minute. We'll come back to him. Let's turn to Michael in Cambridge. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
I called because an earlier caller mentioned the pope's position to reduce or waive third world debt. And if we're thinking about third world debt and the lives of people there, we can't overlook the fact that the Catholic position on condom use has fated hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people to early death.
That is the opposition to condom use.
Yes.
Don't buy it for 5 seconds. It would really be nice if Catholics paid an awful lot of attention to what the Pope says about contraception. There's absolutely no evidence that they do.
Well, wait a minute. The U.S. policy, at least to the extent that it's influenced by religious leaders, has certainly had a very large religious element to it in terms of monies that are spent abroad on birth control. If the Pope comes out against condoms, even to prevent the spread of AIDS, Isn't that something that can be looked straight at? And
wait a minute, you're saying United States policy?
I'm saying U.S. policy has clearly been affected under the Bush administration by religious views on birth control.
Blame Bush, not the Pope, on that.
Well, but you can't separate these things entirely, can you? I mean, religious leaders have influence.
I mean, I don't think so. I think he probably agrees. But I also think that, you know, God knows, condoms are not the answer to these kinds of things.
Well, but it's one answer. Gary Wells, let me turn to you on that one, if I could.
Am I back?
Yes, you are back, Gary.
Well, Ken, I don't know how many journalists you've talked to who have been in Africa, but they think that it has killed many people in Africa, that our inhibiting the spread of condoms there is murder.
Well, I've been to Africa, and I haven't had anybody tell me that kind of thing.
And I've been to Africa, too. Uganda, Tanzania.
I had a journalist from Italy just tell me that the other day.
I mean, clearly, AIDS is an enormous problem there. It is a distinctive stance to say no condoms, even when you've got an onslaught like that. But it is a conservative pope, and we know it. Bren's calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Bren. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I want to say right off the bat, I love your show.
Well, thanks so much.
Just let you know that. I've taught in Poland, so I've seen firsthand how the Pope has affected not only that country, but the Eastern Bloc. And, you know, I certainly agree with all your guests tonight that have, you know, talked about how he was instrumental in changing the face of Europe. And but also, I look at him as a contradiction in the terms of the same way that LBJ was a populist, and I think the Pope is also, but at the same time, LBJ was a bagman for the oil companies and led us into Vietnam. During the 80s and the 90s in South America, his stance, because he was so anti-communism, led to him, you know, sanctioning, you know, priests in South America and Central America, and during that same time period when he was doing all these great things in Europe.
You mean the pushing back against liberation theology?
Well, down in Central America, because they were extreme right wing governments, and in order to help the people down there, the church was aligning themselves with more communist, you know.
Or had been until John Paul II got very involved. And he said, no, let's not do that.
Well, more than just no, he actually excommunicated certain priests.
Right.
And so there again, you have a dichotomy within this man who is a populist on one hand and wants to, you know, help third world countries, and yet in areas where the church could have been very beneficial, he was actually impeding what was good for the people.
But you yourself, Bren, say you've been in Poland. You saw his experience there. He saw Marxism. He saw communism firsthand.
Oh, and it definitely shaped his political viewpoint because of that, you know, because he fought against it. People in Poland, you know, told me, and I've actually, you know, been to the field where they built the workers' church outside of Krakow, where, you know, 100,000 people stood in the pouring rain without a church in protest against the communist government, and the communists couldn't stop them. So, I mean, the power of this man in that area of the world is incredible. And what he's done.
Bren, we've got it. Gary Wells, how about on that front? I mean, this was a pope who had a bitter experience of communism. When he ascended to the papacy, he spread that view right across the world.
Yeah, not only that, he was a very active, politically active priest and bishop. And he decided that he would not have politically active priests and bishops unless they upheld authority. Authority is the issue with him. You know, he could buy authoritarian regimes in Central America much more readily than he could buy any challenge to authority, whether it was communist or not, and a lot of it was not. A good deal of what we're talking about is not theology, it's ideology, it's anti-modernism. Ken Woodward is quite right in saying the changes that have come about are dangerous. They have all kinds of human tragedy involved. So did the scientific revolution. So did the democratic revolution. These great changes take place, and the Pope will reflexively resist them. But in those other earlier cases, and in this case, the church doesn't follow him. You know, people continued to think that the universe went around the sun, not the earth, after Galileo was condemned. And people, John Courtney Murray, continued to think democracy's fine after the Pope said it wasn't. And today, now, people think that contraception's okay, and priests should be married, and women should be ordained by large majorities, very large majorities, no matter what he says. And that's good, because he'll catch up. That's what the Pope did with the scientific revolution and the democratic revolution. You know, for
but isn't there something, let me ask you this, isn't there something, no matter what your view on those particular things, is there something also heroic about a pope standing up in a modern era where a lot of changes are threatening the dignity of the individual? Even science may threaten the dignity of the individual.
Sure.
And saying, slow down,
but,
wait.
Well, but he doesn't say slow down. He says stop. He says, you know, Ken Woodward says it's not all good. Right. It's definitely not all good. But what you do when you say it's all bad is remove your power to distinguish. People stop paying attention to you when you do that. The Pope has much better arguments to make, say, on abortion than on contraception, but he's equally ignored on both because he's trivialized his position with the contraception argument.
Well, I would absolutely agree with that. That certainly has been the Achilles heel that goes back it goes back to Paul VI. And I think it, you know, I would agree with Gary on this. The tragedy of that decision on Humanae Vitae is haunts the church, you know, wherever it is in the world. I would also say that the Pope's, because of his concern for authority, has really got to be held responsible for the widespread lack of real leadership in many, many countries.
On what front? On what front, Ken Woodward? On what front? On what front this lack of
leadership? I think it's Episcopal appointments, wanting to have people who were, in quote, orthodox and, you know, in line with him. He seems as if his ability for discernment was clouded by his, and I would agree with Gary, over preoccupation.
His insistence on orthodoxy. Father Michael Bergeron, let me put it to you. You've traveled with the Pope. You, of course, at the same time know what Gary Wills is talking about, that where there are large majorities of Catholics in many areas who would like to see changes. How do you reconcile the kind of adulation that's clearly out there with, in many corners, desire for changes that the Pope is not signing off on?
I think it's incredible to look at the fact of the amount of people that show up for papal liturgies that do support him. Incredible witnesses to hope, and that's what he calls each and every one of us. He says, again, going back to that homily at his installation, be not afraid, open wide the doors to Christ. The human being today is confronted with great challenges and is in doubt about what they actually have within their mind and their spirit. And it's only by opening up to Christ and the power of Christ and the power of the gospel that each of us can come to the realization of who we are as a human person and the dignity of the human person.
So when the Pope says, be not afraid, what's the fear that he's trying to allay there, Michael Bergeron, Father Bergeron?
Well, again, that whole be not afraid aspect, again, is that because human beings today so often, as he says, you know, we're uncertain about the meaning of our own life on this earth sometimes because of everything that's confronting us, he says we're often assailed by doubt, and doubt turns to despair. So do not be afraid. Again, open wide the doors to Christ. Turn to Christ, who is your strength and your food for the journey. And again, that encourages each and every one of us to become witnesses of hope in our own way.
Do not be afraid of the very faith he represents. We're out of time. Father Michael Bergeron, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Father Michael Bergeron, Executive Director of the Pope John Paul II Cultural Center in Washington, D.C. Kenneth Woodward, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Kenneth Woodward, religion editor at Newsweek magazine, and Gary Wills, historian at Northwestern University, author of Why I Am a Catholic, thanks for being with us tonight.
A pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.